leaders almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close-chested view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? 'Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know to what degree. Yeah, where would we be without THC? The highest side chat show, Greg Carwood Company.
Welcome back to the party, Higher Side Chatters, drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, and diving deep into the field of ufology from sunny San Diego. I'm Greg Carlwood, and folks, we've been down the rabbit hole long enough to be pretty confident we're not alone in the universe, and that elements of the power pyramid know this all too well. From black budget projects aimed at reverse engineering crafts, to rumors of secret ET dealings, to the idea that humanity is being tagged and tracked by alien overseers. It's all there, and when you traverse the field of ufology, I think you'll find that most of what we think we know has been cemented in the counterculture by legendary names like Bob Lazar and John Lear. Well, today's guest, Jeremy Corbell, is an artist, researcher, and filmmaker in Los Angeles who's been lucky enough to spend a good amount of time with both of these guys and more on his quest to better understand the strangeness going on behind the curtain. You can find about a dozen of his films at extraordinarybeliefs.com, and it's a real pleasure to have him here. Jeremy, my man, welcome to THC.
Thanks, Greg. It's awesome to be on.
Oh, for sure, man. Thanks for being here. I think this is going to be a great time. I've been lucky enough to see several of your films and exposés, and the thing that I really need to commend you on, man, is the quality, because to me, that is one of the biggest problems for the conspiracy and ufology communities, and anyone who's really dug into these subjects will know that you typically have to wade through hours and hours of poor audio-video material that really can sometimes be hard to get through, and a lot of people just aren't going to do that. But by bringing professional quality and modern HD cameras to the party, I think you do a lot to bring in new people, and that's kind of an important piece of the puzzle. So great work, man.
Oh, thanks a lot, man. I mean, if there's anything that I would like to contribute to the field of, you know, phenomenology, whatever you call it, you know, it would be to kind of uplift the visual medium. That is something that I saw, you know, was lacking over all those years that I'm looking at it. And so the best that I can with the equipment that I, you know, have and my own vision, I'm trying to do that. So I appreciate that. But it's everybody's job, man. We all got to work at it.
I do concur. So let me ask you, how did you get on this track, man? Because it seems like you've developed pretty solid relationships with some of the big names in this community, not only Bob Lazar and John Lear, but also Dr. Roger Lear, George Knapp, astronaut Edgar Mitchell. It's a pretty impressive roster, man. What sent you down this path?
You know, the story for me basically begins when I was 13 years old. I listened to some sort of broadcast that had George Knapp, John Lear, Bob Lazar, Gene Huff, and they were talking about the alleged, you know, reverse engineering program that was being done at S4 around 1989. And the way that Bob Lazar described the propulsion system completely just flipped the script for me. You know, I always imagined as things kind of traverse space that they're being propelled like a rocket, you know, dumping, you know, fuel as it goes.
Right, right.
But as you know, the way he described it, it is absolutely counterintuitive until you understand it. And that description of the propulsion system just, I like to say, weaponized my curiosity. It just completely opened my mind to the possibilities that things are, completely different than what we imagine them to be. You know, I would say that's how it started for me, and that was the moment that I first remember being absolutely fascinated with these topics. You know, and then you go on with your life, and you're a kid, and you do what you do, and you know, you follow the path of your life. And mine happened to be jiu-jitsu. That was like the number one thing that I wanted to do with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a unique experience, you know, with a health issue, and it forced me to move from doing something that was so physical into engaging these topics that had been such a curiosity and a kind of a secret passion for me for a long time. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got started. I think the first phone call that I ever made specifically to engage this topic was to John Lear. You know, I figured Here's a guy at the nexus of every conspiracy theory I have ever read about in my life. If yeah. there's anybody that's got an opinion, you know, it's going to be John Lear. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's kind of the godfather of conspiracy.
Yeah.
And, you know, from there, I mean, I tried every which way to get a hold of him. For like 3 years, I was trying to get a hold of him and just never got a call back, never got an answer, never picked up the phone. I don't know what was going on at that time of his life, but it just didn't pan out for me. And then, you know, through all of this, I tried to get to, and finally, you know, finally one day, you know, I get a call and it's a, Jeremy, this is John. I hear you're trying to get a hold of me. What do you want to talk about? You know, and that was the beginning of this kind of strange and bizarre journey for me.
Right on. That is awesome, man. Yeah, I know all too well it can be hard to get a hold of some of these people, but that is awesome, man. You've also had a couple of sightings of things in the sky yourself since you started this filming journey, haven't you?
Well, I mean, I think what specifically you're talking about, if you, you know, kind of look up on the internet, you'll see something called the Silver Surfer. This was a total anomalous situation. I was walking with my wife in Santa Monica, where we lived at the time, and, you know, I have my iPhone and I'm messing with it somehow, and I look up at the sky and I see these two spiraling, you know, kind of shimmering silver. It was very impressive. I've never seen anything like it before in my life. And I raised my camera up and I, you know, took a really crappy, shaky video. And I remember saying on the video, like, what in the F is this? This looks like the Silver Surfer. And, you know, being that I started, you know, kind of my interest in this, I said, well, let me just send it to the local news and just see if anybody else in Santa Monica saw it. I wasn't claiming anything. I was simply saying, not only did I see this, but I filmed it. Did anybody else film it or see it? And that kind of started a hailstorm. You know, the media immediately put it up on air right next to Bill Nye and having Bill Nye kind of analyze my footage. And, you know, oh, I was like, oh, this is cool when it started. And then all of a sudden, he comes out with, well, this footage is most likely faked. And he probably superimposed brine shrimp, which I had to look up on Google, which are sea monkeys, you know, into the video. And it made me livid because here I am, you know, really interested in what the truth might be. And this right. is like, you know, this is the mountain of scientific reason who's saying I superimpose sea monkeys. It's like the modern day version of swamp gas from Project Blue Book, you know, unbelievable. So I spent, you know, a solid week of my life saying, well, I bet there's a way we can do this with modern technology, you know? And so essentially created like a Facebook group back when, you know, you did that and collected about, I'd say 6 to 8 videos of these same objects all throughout the Santa Monica area, including a video taken by some famous basketball player, I guess, that was on TMZ. And so nobody knew what this was. And I had this aeronautics specialist who triangulated the descent rate, the size, all this stuff. I mean, these objects were real. We had them on camera. I was never claiming they were extraterrestrial. I was asking, what are they? They're UFOs. Yeah. They're unidentified. Sure enough, finally, I was able to discover that they were Red Bull skydivers with flares on their ankles. And I actually have the video of the diver jumping out of the plane. He was nice enough to give it to me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was kind of like my first, you know, kick in the pants, like, so this is how it's going to be, huh? Mm-hmm. You know, when you start looking into this weird stuff, there's a natural resistance and a way to play it in the media that it not only mocks it, but, you know, discredits the people who come forward with information.
Yeah, isn't that funny how even though the footage turned out to be something identifiable, you still got a taste of the dismissive nature of the mainstream, a taste of the wrath of the gatekeepers, because I guess you weren't trying to say it was something otherworldly, maybe hoping, but you're just asking the question,
right.
What the F is that? And it's frustrating to see the explanations go straight to manipulation, straight to, well, this guy's a scammer. You know, it does suck. But I think in recent years, at least, it's kind of changed for some people. I think they've become a bit more open because they have just better access to a whole host of strange footage captured in the sky.
I mean, a couple comments on that. One is that, you know, we police ourselves with this. You know, we do it to ourselves worse than anybody does it to us. And, you know, I think the laugh factor of people that just want to seek the unknown to begin with, really, it's most likely because of fear. It's the idea of being uncomfortable that the world is not actually, you know, as it appears. And I think with a cursory glance into this UFO phenomenon, or, you know, all the phenomena connected to the UFO matter, it becomes immediately evident.
Right.
I mean, immediately evident that there's something bigger going on, has been going on since the beginning of recorded human history, and that every watchdog agency on this planet in the intelligence community knows about it to some degree. And, you know, has made a point, and we know this through FBI documents, have made a point to make and create a laugh factor, you know, a discrediting force.
Oh, yeah.
So that we self-discredit. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they've even got it so finely tuned that the word truther is a negative label to put on someone. I mean, I think that's probably the furthest extent of language manipulation. It's kind of funny, but... You know, I've never been lucky enough to see a UFO myself. There are hot spots out there that I'd like to spend more time at. And I saw you post something, this is kind of random, but something about the Desert Yeti Ranch and a blurb about it being one. I haven't heard of Desert Yeti Ranch. Is this a real thing or were you goofing around?
Well, okay. So first of all, let me just say, I've never seen something that I can, I'm kind of in your camp. You know, I've never seen the mothership. I've never seen a spaceship that I can't describe. I have seen anomalous aerial phenomenon, mostly in the form of lights in the sky, you know, day or night, and I have no idea what they are. And they certainly defied the known physics that I am aware of. But I have no proof if this stuff is, you know, military compared to natural phenomenon. I have no idea.
Right.
So I'm in the same camp as you. My confidence in the fact that this is all going on comes from a wide variety of other sources, not because I had some abductive experience. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing you're bringing up is hilarious because I'm just going to stay silent on that. But I have a ranch that I live in LA, but I also have a ranch out in Pioneertown, California. And upon spending more time out here, there has been, you know, a pretty incredible display of aerial phenomenon. And I think this area is kind of known for that. I mean, if people know about Pioneertown, California, it's, you know, real near to the Integratron and where Van Tassel did all of his, you know, wild stuff. So there is a rich history out here, and we're by a huge military base. I mean, that might be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of like a internal reference just for my friends.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's funny because I'm always looking for those spots. Of course, Skinwalker Ranch is out there. Also, I'm not sure if you're familiar, but James Gilliland's Esetti Ranch near Trout Lake. I hear that's a place where people see all kinds of things. And what's intriguing there is a lot of the things tend to come out of the base of a mountain, which, you know, when it comes to mysterious things, I'm always interested in an underground element or some kind of like, you know, hidden in a mountain base type element. But apparently that's pretty common up there in, I think it's in Trout Lake, Oregon or Washington.
Yeah, you know, I've heard a little bit about it. I think what makes the Skinwalker Ranch story most compelling is that the history of how it was purchased by Robert Bigelow. I mean, here's an individual now, you know, going to attach, you know, inflatable habitats onto the ISS. He has had for decades two, you know, personal habitable orbiting space stations. I mean, here's a guy who's on the bleeding edge of technology and decided to put more money than any living human being or any individual ever in the history of the world has put into researching this stuff, yet now is completely focused on space exploration. But at the time, you know, put a team of scientists, and that's the book we know, Hunt for the Skinwalker, you know, the primary author being George Knapp with his other author. And it's an incredible location.
Yeah.
What has occurred there is almost beyond belief. But in fact, it appears that it has occurred. These things have occurred there. And there are other places like this. That's why they put the book out, was to find out if there were other places like this. And sure enough, there are.
Yeah, the Skinwalker Ranch, there's so many strange things about it. Most of it I was familiar with, but I did hear you talking about it on, a previous interview, and you had mentioned a black mist that seemed to possess people in some way, and I hadn't heard of that before, but it almost sounds like a swarm of nanobots or something like that.
Oh, now you're talking my language. I mean, that's where, you know, I start to get kind of excited that there is a technological aspect to these seemingly paranormal things. I mean, that story was relayed, you know, to me, I believe, by George himself. But I think it's in the book, or at least there's an article that came out about it and about the scientist that had that experience. But, you know, essentially he was paralyzed and there was an intelligence speaking through his body, as crazy as that sounds. But yes, that black mist, that idea of technologically advanced miniaturized robots that all work in unison towards a similar goal, nanobots, right? Utility fog. I mean, if that was real technology, that would be incredible.
Yeah, it would. And that's pretty far out there, but I guess this is a question that comes up with a lot of the technological stuff that seems outside of humanity's grasp. It's the same argument with the crafts. How are they able to make right angle turns in midair? How are they hovering that way when we don't have any known crafts that can do that? But what do you think about the idea that you don't need to bring aliens in to explain this stuff, that the military black ops groups have gone so far down their research holes at these underground bases and they're so far ahead of the surface world, almost like a breakaway civilization in their own right, that what they have seems alien? I mean, I'm not someone who tries to say much one way or the other, but there has been a trend in the alternative community to attribute a lot of these things to the black project groups instead of aliens. But what are your thoughts? Do you think you need to bring in ET to explain some of the things people have seen?
No, but I also don't believe that military black budget programs could even start scraping the surface of what humanity has experienced, again, since the beginning of recorded human history. So, you know, the fundamental answer to that is, you know, look, before there was a car, that was beyond, you know, humanity's grasp. Before there was the first airplane, that was beyond humanity's grasp. That's just the way that the world progresses. These things that we're seeing, these experiences that we're having that seem technologically advanced to where we are at right now, you know, maybe at one time in human history, we look up and we say, whoa, that must be the gods coming from heaven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that everything we're seeing, and we all saw this from years ago, that you know, drones were going to be the next thing. Everybody's going to say, oh, that's just a drone in the sky. Well, fundamentally, you know, that's always going to be the way we explain stuff. But our black projects, I mean, I've talked to people, you know, deep within inside the military industrial complex that were in charge and in command of the bases and programs that dealt with the development of, you know, a number of these advanced technologies. And their responses, you know, off the record to me have always been, we wish we had the capabilities that we document and record on a daily basis invading our airspace.
Hmm.
So,
yeah, they'd be the ones to know.
Yeah.
Man. So it also is hard to explain away, like you kind of mentioned, old accounts. You know, there are old paintings and ancient writings where they talk about people riding snakes in the sky that spit fire. I mean, that sounds like a plane or a rocket to me. And you had a presentation at the 2015 UFO Congress that I thought was super interesting. And from that presentation and your background was this little story about this 1866 lithograph of George Washington in his Masonic garb. Of course, I love anything that connects both conspiracy and ufology, but tell us about this lithograph, because this is another one of those types of bits of evidence that is even older, so it makes it hard to explain away with, well, modern technology could be doing it.
Yeah, that was a fascinating, you know, again, this is one of those things that I just fixated upon because I stumbled across it and it hadn't been put forward yet. It's definitely not the most interesting, you know, painting or lithograph of an unknown object that appears, you know, from an artist standpoint to be deliberately created to look, you know, like a flying saucer. There's a Flemish painter, I think last name is Gelder, G-E-L-D-E-R, and he painted something called The Baptism of Christ, and it was painted in 1710. And this painting shows a flying disc just shooting beams of light down during the baptism of Christ. I mean, it is an absolutely incredible, I mean, there was nothing in the air mechanical in 1710.
Right.
So, no, from us. So that's an incredible painting. Now, the George Washington one, why that one piqued my interest is because I was searching the Library of Congress and I was just kind of looking for Masonic imagery and ufology stuff and came across this lithograph, the one you're talking about from 1866. And when I looked at it at first, it looked like typical Masonic imagery. And, you know, everything has a place. Everything has a balance and place in Masonic imagery. Mm-hmm. Except when I focused in on the Jacob's ladder, you know, which is where angels, which are messengers, ascend and descend from heaven. I'm looking at this object and I started doing color correction and tweaking, and you can see the green, red, yellow, and black paint that was put on, you know, because of modern technology, thank you. And it's amazing. You know, there is a, to me, it looks like a ship.
Yeah.
So again, I'm not making any claims. I'm just saying, hey, raising my hand, I found this. What do you think it is?
Right. Yeah. I think those old references are a great counterpoint to that argument that it all just could be a breakaway human civilization, because it gets harder and harder to justify that answer when you go back and you see things flying in the sky from 1700s and 1800s imagery. But we talked about nanobots just a minute. I wanted to bring up Nanoman. This was one of the first videos of yours that I saw, Nanoman and his utility fog. And let me read a part of the copy here so people can get some context for this. But a military-funded nanophysicist known for advanced propulsion systems discovers mysterious forces while building a device intended for interstellar space travel. This strange propulsion may provide hard physical proof for the existence of the multiverse. Nanoman also believes he possesses a mysterious metamaterial not created here on Earth. Is this physical evidence of extraterrestrial nanotechnology from a UFO landing site, or has everyone been fooled for some deeper reason? That is an excellent primer, man, and I really loved that video, but how the hell did you find this guy?
Yeah, how did I find Nanoman? So I'm calling him Nanoman just for now. I mean, you know, I've got a series of film pieces on his exploits, everything from propulsion systems to, you know, his claims on this utility fog. So it's not like some big secret. He's one of these lucky people that's not under contract, mm-hmm. you know, where he can do whatever he wants. So at some point, I'm going to reveal that. But how I found him, oddly enough, was through a number of my military friends who were consulting for him. And, you know, they know what I'm interested in. Not that they're interested in it, but they keep their ears and eyes open for me. And they were like, you know, you really should check out what he's doing with propulsion, because I know that's what you're fascinated with fundamentally. And I said, great, I'll check it out. So I went to go interview with him and document some of what he's doing on what he calls the Space Drive, which is the new short I will be releasing most likely at the 2016 International UFO Congress in the Film Festival. And it highlights that technology that he has been building, testing, and creating. Now, in those conversations with him, after the course of a few days, it quickly became apparent that his inspiration and his kind of dead set knowledge that certain things were possible stemmed from somewhere else. It stemmed from other experiences that he had that he wasn't telling me.
Mm.
So over the course of kind of earning his trust over a number of days, kind of the floodgates opened. And one of the things that he said to me is what you experienced in that short film. He says, you know, I've got something you might be interested in. I was like, all right, well, what's that? And he goes up into his upstairs laboratory at the time, comes out with a vial filled with what looks like water. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, okay, what is this? You know? And he says, well, inside here are trillions and trillions of independent nanobots. And I didn't even know what that meant. You know, he said micro machines that he had collected that somehow worked together in unison towards a single goal, utility fog. I had never heard these words before. Right. So now I'm starting to think the guy's a little bit off, not wound so tight, right? But I don't know. He's showing me a vial of water. So as a self-proclaimed investigative journalist, right? What is my job? My job is to take it and see if I can verify any of his results. So he backs up his statements, you know, saying this is what he believes, not really telling me quite where he got it from yet, by showing me the scanning electron microscope images of what he perceived to be gears and you know, graspers and just, you know, mechanical parts.
Right.
And I mean, I didn't even understand the magnitude of which I was looking at these things at. I mean, you know, two nanometers. So I kind of just laughed about it, like, well, how is someone like myself ever going to validate that inside your little liquid here you have, you know, some non-terrestrial, super intelligent material, you know? Mm-hmm. And he says, well, you should go see. I mean, he said this was 9 years ago. I imaged this stuff. He's like, I have no idea if it's, you know, dissolved, broke down, if it's still there. He says, why don't you take it and have it analyzed at like NASA? And I was like, okay, well, how am I going to do that? You know?
Right.
And he's like, well, let me make some calls. Let me see if I can get you a tech. And I didn't believe that he was going to get. So there I am, NASA Ames in a little bit of central North California. It's an old Moffett airfield military base. And sure enough, I had a non-restricted, unescorted, full media pass to film for an entire day uh-huh. with a technician on a scope, which costs a lot of money, to look at this, what looks like water to me, and see if, in fact, we can replicate visually what he had imaged 9 years prior.
Yeah.
So that's the film. The film is me taking it there and just trying to replicate visually what he had seen. And then if we could do that, then the guy's not lying to me. And then, you know, new questions arise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, it's pretty awesome. And he makes one comment where he says it shouldn't exist for another 1,000 years. I'm curious if you can share, how did he come across this, if it's not something that he developed?
Well, okay, so right now, what I'm doing is I am attempting to have this and other materials analyzed, and I don't want to kind of pollute the well.
Fair.
By, you know, saying, you know, where he got. Obviously, he believes this is some advanced technology. I have said before, so I can say again, you know, this is a powdered dust, I guess, a metallic powdered dust, often found. You know, if you read any Jacques Vallée, he's done extensive studies on this, that there are residues that can be found at UFO landing sites.
Mm-hmm.
Some people even, you know, claiming in crop circles.
Right.
And, you know, where commonly abductions occur. Now, again, I am not a hardcore believer in any of this, you know, when it comes to the, you know, these outside. All I'm trying to do is find out if there is anything we can study of substance surrounding these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so what, you know, that's what I can say about where he got it is, you know, he's been shown a number of things in the years prior to him being a nanotechnologist that convinced him beyond a shadow of a doubt that there are civilizations that have created technology so advanced that they do appear like magic to us. But his belief is, since they have done it, we will be able to do it one day.
Well, it is fascinating stuff. And I do agree with you that getting some kind of verifiable trace evidence and getting that out into the public eye is a big part of what's needed to change the mindset around ufology, because some people will not budge until they're dragged to the truth, kicking and screaming. And on the flip side, to have a population that has such a high mark to reach before they'll even be open-minded about these possibilities means the elite only really have to catch the big stuff to avoid having any real problems on their hands. Very convenient.
Look, ultimately, the messengers of deception and the architects of the secrecy, we know who they are. They're not us. I mean, ultimately, if there are intelligent non-humans or just other intelligent beings that are operating these craft above our skies with impunity for, you know, a long time, let's just say, you know, at any given time, they could show themselves. So, you know, as we peel away layer by layer and try to kind of perforate this veil of illusion or secrecy, you know, we will have some little bit of success here or there. But look, it's a pretty difficult thing to do. We can kind of peek behind and do our best.
Yeah.
And I'm not thinking that anything any of us are doing is just going to like crack this wide open. But it is fascinating and it is life changing in a way. And I think that's what's important.
Right.
You know, ultimately how we engage each other and the foundation of our principles of how we relate to one another. If our worldview expands to the point of transcending, you know, hunger and fear, then we may be able to build together, you know, a world that is slightly more interesting than if we're just operating based on competition.
Yeah.
So I believe that this search for the unknown and this kind of gentle and methodic interrogation of what is behind this veil helps us to be better humans.
Yeah.
And I think that ultimately that's what matters.
Amen, man. I agree. So let me ask you, have you been in contact with anyone else working on anything as technologically advanced as Nanoman?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Right on. Can you tell us about any of the other people you've spoken with that have something interesting in their possession?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're talking about, you know, actual physical proof of non-human intelligence creating some technologically advanced thing, you know, there are a lot of people that claim that. And, you know, most famously is, you know, Bob Lazar and what he worked on using Element 115. But, you know, there are a number of people. I don't know that we'll ever, you know, I believe real evidence is swooped up and people are, you know, threatened just like, you know, at the Brazel Ranch during the Roswell crash. I mean, not a single piece made it out into the public, man.
Yeah.
You know, so any real proof is like pretty much controlled at the highest level. But what I will say is there are people now working on technologies that we as humans have been told are completely impossible, such as cold fusion. We know that the fundamental physics of cold fusion holds up, that it exists, but to harness it in a cost efficient and effective way, right? That is kind of the key.
Yeah.
So with some of these scientists, we call them the Invisible College, coined by Jacques Vallée. You know, these scientists that give their time, effort, resources, and materials to help people like myself or any researcher kind of move the needle forward. Okay, so within this group of people, some of the interesting things that I've been exposed to, and I will be putting out films on this stuff, it's all filmed already, is the endeavor to harness cold fusion. There has been great leaps and bounds that have been made in this field specifically due to nanotechnology. And the reason is because we have now metamaterials, alloys, that have never existed in, you know, ever in human history. They have never existed. But we can almost perfectly atomically lay down atoms of metals. And in fact, we can now grow metals. I don't know if you saw that. I don't know if you saw that article. It was in Fortune magazine. It was August 25th, 2015. So really recently. Right. And there was a startup company called ModuMetal. And they are growing high-performance metals using,
yes,
electricity and nanotechnology. And it's cheap, and it's efficient, and it's effective. And I actually asked Bob Lazar about this process because it dawned on me this is exactly what Bob was saying in 1989, that it looked like an injection mold, that it, maybe it was grown or something, this craft that he worked on. Mm-hmm. And his exact quote is, "This is quite possibly exactly how the craft structure was formed. And I think it's potentially a very important connection." He said that on September 3rd, 2015. So essentially, in the long way around answering your question, yes, I've been exposed to some really badass technologies. And what I think is, when you just read the media and you see how these metamaterials that have never existed before have unique principles, and now we're being able to grow them, metals, mm-hmm. you know, the leaps and bounds, man. We are on the precipice.
Yeah, man. Let's talk Bob Lazar a little bit. I mean, obviously, a legend in this realm, claimed to have been involved in the back engineering of an alien craft at the S4 base near Groom Lake. He's been out there for over 25 years, really, as a whistleblower for this. What are your thoughts on Bob and his story? It's kind of controversial.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very controversial because, you know, you have inconsistencies, you have deception, you have people of high credibility protecting their previous statements just, you know, to save face. You have, you know, people like George Knapp for 25 years knocking on doors, cracking this case open, never letting it go. And, you know, it's amazing. You know, Bob came out and told a story. And sure, there's a very human element to this story, and Bob is not a very open person, so he has not remedied a lot of the BS that has gone around, which he easily could. But are you aware of the Dr. Krangle interview that I recently put out?
I heard you talk about it on a previous show, but I was going to ask you about that as a way to kind of back up Bob Lazar's story. But yeah, please let us know about Krangle.
Yeah, I mean, look, my thing was not just to back up Lazar's story. I mean, I thought it was amazing. And I actually went in to meet, you know, John Lear and George Knapp. And I just thought it was going to be these guys just messing with everybody. Honestly, I didn't have an opinion. I just was, you know, there seemed to be so much chaos around this story that I had deep skepticism. Mm-hmm. I don't even know where to start with the Lazar story, just essentially that where I'm standing now, that's kind of what I think is important. I've looked into this case probably more than anybody other than, you know, George Knapp. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and he has, again, been my mentor through everything. It's pretty unbelievable what he has done, that people just don't even understand how much he's committed to investigating the unexplained rather than explaining the uninvestigated, as he likes to say.
Yeah.
But with the Lazar case, I no longer have the luxury of disbelief. Lazar, I am now at a point where I will say straightforward, I believe Bob Lazar. I believe his story entirely. And I believe he worked at S4. I believe he worked on what he said he worked on. If these guys were trying to pull an elaborate hoax, trust me, I would know by now. So, the Dr. Krangle interview. People like Stan Freeman, he holds a huge respect in the UFO world. He's done some great things.
Right.
But he has consistently, you know, slammed Lazar as being a fraud and a con man, which two words, which I would say require some definition if he's going to say them, right?
Right.
And essentially, you know, there's a guy with great respect, and I was thrown up on stage to have a, in quotes, debate. I had no idea I was going to have to. And, you know, these words keep coming up, and it starts kind of aggravating me because, you know, this is not the crux of his story. The crux of his story is that he back-engineered alien spacecraft, not of this Earth, at a sub-base of Area 51 called S4. No one was able to verify, you know, on camera, on audio, that they were there at even Los Alamos with Bob Lazar. Yet I know George Knapp has talked to many people off the record who worked at Los Alamos. George Knapp brought forward Bob's name in the phone directory. George Knapp was going to get all of Bob's files. They admitted that he worked at Los Alamos, but then they pulled it back in and they didn't give him, you know, all of the proof that he would need. I happen to know George Knapp even has video of walking around with Bob inside Los Alamos, you know, while he's showing him around.
Wow.
I've known dozens of people, you know, that have confirmed that, but no one on the record, because they don't want to break the mold. They don't want to commit professional suicide. So, and 25 years later, I mean, Bob doesn't even really try to push this because he'd rather be left alone with all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But here's this guy, Dr. Robert Krangle. He's an Albuquerque-based scientist. He reports to have his doctorate from MIT from 1973 in semiconductor physics. He's been an engineering consultant at Sandia Labs, Los Alamos, since the 80s. He still works there from time to time. He verified and showed me his credentials from his work at White Sands, China Lake, and even contracts he filled that were distributed by Homeland Security. So this is a real scientist, bona fide, who tells me the story of working at Los Alamos in the 80s with Bob the nuclear physicist, in quotes. And he said that we all knew Bob. We all knew he committed professional suicide when he spoke out about what he was working for in for the military. And he made it abundantly clear that he was in security briefings with Lazar at Los Alamos, and Lazar was a physicist. And this is the first person to go on record. The first person. So what that proves is Lazar worked at Los Alamos. So people like Stan can no longer say, oh, he was probably the janitor.
Right. I had heard that argument. And I guess, yeah, I mean, the major issue, the thing that seems to be the big thorn in the side of this story revolves around the records, or at least that's what people are making it about. He has no IDs or cards from MIT or Caltech, the school that he says he went to. But, you know, I fully believe that the shadow state can erase a person's records. And if I had to prove that I went to Mizzou with documents that I have in my possession now, I might actually struggle because I don't hold on to stuff like that. But has this issue of the records ever really bothered you?
Yeah, well, there's a difference between the records and the claimed education. The records have never been an issue. We already, you know, we know that, I mean, this is something that, like, why would I ever say this? But, I mean, I talked to the medical staff at Los Alamos, one of the medical staff, and, you know, was verified that, you know, Lazar has his whole medical charts there. I've never publicly said that. All these little breadcrumbs, you know, the records that he worked at Los Alamos, we have the records.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now the question is, did he then work at S4, this subbase? And we can get into that and why, you know, what he said has been kind of, you know, trickled out and verified over all this time. But, you know, the records haven't been the problem. The education is what people have a problem with. You know, Bob claimed certain things like a degree from MIT, blah, blah, blah. Dr. Krangle actually said in the interview, well, you know, I said, well, why isn't there a yearbook photo of Bob Lazar at MIT during that time? And he goes, well, if he was, you know, doing kind of graduate work, if he wasn't just like a class of, you know, 1980 or whatever it was, he wouldn't be in the yearbook. But I've never followed that path of logic as being important.
Mm-hmm.
Let's pretend the worst. Let's pretend Bob Lazar completely lied about all of his educational credentials and he was homeschooled. Okay. let's push it there. Okay.
Sure.
He was homeschooled. Okay. What difference does that make about flying saucers? I mean, you could say, well, he lied about that if he did. Well, okay. But he did in fact work at Los Alamos in the Maison facility with the particle accelerator. The guy had a particle accelerator in his own living room when he was living in Las Vegas. He built another one out in Albuquerque, New Mexico, when he lived there. I mean, the guy is a scientist of the highest degree with current scientific contracts from everyone from the Navy to a number of other agencies.
Right.
So Bob's a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
Bob worked in technical capacity at Los Alamos. I don't feel that if other people couldn't uncover the education stuff, what good am I going to do there? I want to focus and keep my eye on the prize. Did Bob back engineer alien spacecraft at a subbase of Area 51? That's what fascinates me.
Right.
Let's try to uncover that.
Yeah, good point. That is kind of the only thing that really matters in the story. But you mentioned element 115. I've, of course, heard of this before, but some people might not have. Talked to us a little bit about Element 115. Bob claimed it was the fuel for the UFOs, but also, I mean, he talked about this 25 years ago, but there were some mainstream scientific revelations about it just like a year ago or something, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, a number of years ago. So essentially, just, you know, to back it up and make it really simple for people that, you know, don't have access to the internet right now and should be typing this in, okay? So element 115 is a theorized element, a super heavy element. You know, it's no surprise. It's not like, you know, Bob made it up. Element 115 is this, you know, it was always theorized that it could exist, but our supernova never, you know, created it in any abundance that we could detect, and so it was never on our periodic chart or table. But we figured one day maybe we'd be able to fabricate over months and months and millions of dollars in a particle accelerator, maybe a few atoms of it that would last most likely milliseconds because of its half-life, right? Mm-hmm. So it's this kind of like funny element, and it kind of had a blank spot on the periodic table. So in 1989, Bob Lazar tells his story, and part of his story hinges around like what you said, the fuel source, what you would put in the gravity amplifier and or the antimatter reactor that would then engage the gravity amplifiers, which is how you traverse space-time without any G-force issues. Mm-hmm. So this piece of alleged element 115 became kind of the argumentative point, because you have other nuclear physicists who say, well, the half-life of 115 is so minuscule that you could never have a substantial amount to work with. And Bob was claiming that there was at least one stabilized piece or a few that he worked with, but that he was told there were 500 pounds of this, that maybe the size of like a washing machine basket or something, you know, of 115.
Hmm.
So, you know, the scientific community can kind of jump on this and say, well, there's no way. The isotopes will not stabilize, and you cannot have this. But there is the theorized island of stability where element 115 could be stabilized. Now this, again, it's theoretical, but you were right. A number of years ago, there were scientists that did this process, and they bombarded in a particle accelerator, and were able to manifest, like, you know, a few atoms of this, which quickly deteriorated into nothing. So this is like the number one thing that people fight with when it comes to Lazar's 115 argument. The thing that people forget is that Lazar never claimed that we made the 115. He didn't even claim really how he knows that we had it. He was just briefly told that we have 500 pounds of it to kind of work with. So the theory would be that it was harvested. It was harvested from somewhere else, maybe where it was naturally occurring. Mm-hmm. So it is, you know, from another supernova or something like that. So that's the story of the 115. I kind of botched the, I'm not a scientist, obviously. Mm-hmm. I'm an investigative journalist. But that is what people should look up. The element 115, island of stability, they should look at the half-life and see why people are all up in arms about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting saga for sure. I mean, a lot of it does hinge on that 115. But I guess another thing I'm curious about, saying that they might have, you know, 500 pounds of this stuff and they might not have made it, they might have harnessed it, but I'm wondering if perhaps it was even given. There are a lot of rumors about partnerships between sectors of the government and ET races. One of the big speculations is an exchange of technology for the ability to run a certain number of abductions. That's come up a lot. I'm curious what your thoughts are about a partnership versus everything that we have being gathered from crashes or recovered from incidents. Do you think there's any real sustained communication, or do you think we're kind of in the dark just trying to piece things together as we find them?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating question. And just to reiterate, it's not he said we harvested it, you know, or sorry, it's not that he said we harnessed it. It's that maybe it was harvested. So if element 115, this stabilized element 115, isotope, that's the word. You know, if it has the right isotopic combination, mm-hmm. it's theorized it can be stabilized. That was the word I was looking for earlier. So essentially, if we did have this significant amount of stabilized element 115, Bob himself theorized that it must have been harvested from somewhere else. And if it was harvested from somewhere else, maybe where it was naturally occurring in another supernova, then it must have been brought here as cargo. And if it was brought here as cargo, I mean, most likely we didn't shoot down some advanced technological machine. I mean, it's possible, I guess, but it seemed to me if we did actually have nine of these craft and hangars that looked like right off the factory line, that somehow they were exchanged or given to us. And I can make that assumption maybe with this 115 if it does exist in the form and way in which it's described. So is there a program of relation between humanity and non-humans that's been going on for some time? And is it part of our government or even a sub-government within our government? Your guess, buddy, is as good as mine. I mean, I don't know, but it, you know, all arrows point to there's got to be some sort of communication for us to have this kind of vast amount of technology from another world. Mm-hmm. That alone is the reason why, one of the reasons why Bob Lazar felt he had to come out. Mm-hmm. You know, it was that. That fact alone, that we have technological craft from another star system, from other beings, you know, that is something that people, you know, should be able to know. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, when we're talking about the idea of, you know, is there an exchange program, you know, is there information out there that's being guarded about this program, it makes you think of Gary McKinnon. Yes. And the Yeah, and as a whistleblower, the things that he brought forward about, you know, non-terrestrial officers and the idea of cargo ships and transport lists, and I mean, he knew where to look. That's a pretty amazing story, and that brings us into Snowden and his recent comments. Did you happen to hear about his extraterrestrial encryption comments?
I saw the headlines. I didn't dig too much into it, though, but tell us what he said.
Okay, well why this is fascinating is because I think he really stepped in crap accidentally here. I don't think he meant this to be picked up like this, but September 18th, 2015, he was on Neil deGrasse Tyson's show that he hosts called Star Talk, I think it's a podcast. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, Snowden said, and I actually have the quotes, it's interesting. Basically, he's talking about extraterrestrial encryption and how we might not be able to determine signals because any advanced society ends up using encryption systems that look like, you know, garbage if you're just looking at them. So we could miss it, kind of like the Fermi paradox. The Fermi paradox is essentially the assumed contradiction between the high estimates and probability of the existence of extraterrestrial civilizations and the cosmic silence. Like, where are all the school buses from another planet showing kids Earth, right? So right, that was the Fermi paradox. So, you know, with Snowden's comments, I got it right here, I'll read it to you. So if you have an alien civilization trying to listen for other civilizations, or our civilization trying to listen for aliens, there's only one small period in the development of their society when all of their communication will be sent via the most primitive and most unprotected means. Because, you know, we're talking to a security expert here. Mm-hmm. He continues. He says, so when we think about everything that we're hearing through our satellites or everything that they're hearing from other civilization, if there are indeed aliens out there, he adds, all of their communications are encrypted by default. So what we are hearing, it's actually an alien television show or, you know, a phone call, is indistinguishable to us from cosmic microwave background radiation. So that was his exact quote.
Right on.
Yeah, and like what I thought was so fascinating about that is, you know, he's essentially saying there's this brief moment in a civilization's time where we'll be able to pick stuff up because encryption will just become an everyday thing and it will be indistinguishable from, you know, background microwave cosmic radiation. Mm-hmm. It made me think that there people have theorized that in the Snowden leaks that there's going to be some UFO stuff. Mm-hmm. I think that is total BS. The NSA systems that Snowden had access to, is kind of like the internal intelligence internet of sorts, was really low level. If you think about it, you know, Snowden was a systems analyst, a cyber strategist. He was not the overlord of the Black Project Empire, you know?
Right.
So because of compartmentalization and the function of the NSA, Snowden and his releases were just scraping the surface. There will be no UFO disclosure documents within whatever he had to release, in my personal opinion. But it was cool that he said anything about the ET issue.
Right. Yeah, it's always great to hear anyone in the mainstream say anything about it. I know recently, God, Clinton was on one of the late night talk shows and he said something and everybody pounced on it. It was just like one sentence or something about the possibility or that he sent one of his guys to go look into it. And I mean, I know all our mouths are watering. We want to hear ex-presidents, current presidents, anyone in positions of authority or positions of having special access to knowledge. We want to hear them even talk about it, even anything, you know. And it is crazy that someone says one thing and that gets talked about for the next two decades.
In fact, though, the Clinton thing was interesting. and here's why. I agree with everything you just said. But Clinton was an interesting president in that he actually did. One of his first things he did in his presidency was he sent one of his primary aides to go get information on Area 51 and about it. I mean, he has interest in ETs. And he was denied access. And this is what is so astounding, I think, to people. It was to me. It was mind-boggling that the president of the United States does not have necessary, they might have the level of, you know, security level, but they don't necessarily have the need to know. Mm-hmm. So presidents such as Clinton have been denied access to fundamental things like Area 51.
Right.
I mean, it makes sense. They're there for 8 years max. But it's just, it was astounding when I first kind of grasped that there are people within government who will sustain their roles far beyond that of the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And that they have power to even tell the president that they may have clearance, but they don't have the need to know.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm with you there. And another thing about Clinton that's really interesting. See, I know what your thoughts are, well, I have a good idea what your thoughts are about the moon landing. And this isn't necessarily about the moon landing hoax, but this is an interesting quote from Bill Clinton's book. He said, "Just a month before Apollo 11 walked on the moon, an old carpenter asked me if I really believed it happened. I said, sure, I saw it on television. He disagreed. He said that he didn't believe it for a minute and that them television fellers could make things look real that weren't. Back then, I thought he was a crank. During my 8 years in Washington, I saw some things on TV that made me wonder if he wasn't ahead of his time." I mean, that's a pretty cryptic statement to come from a president. That's bold. There's no need to write that in a book, you know?
I don't think it's cryptic at all. I think what he's saying is you should doubt everything and you should doubt things even such as the moon landing. And that was a kind of problematic thing for me when I went out to go spend a few days filming with Dr. Edgar Mitchell, you know, allegedly the sixth man to walk on the moon. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I've never really made a statement on this, so I'll just, you know, be clear. I'm not, although I find it fascinating, I'm not one of those people who is like, we never went to the moon like a lot of my, you know, friends are. You know, I think we had the technology to do so at the time. I think there were huge programs of people that were, you know, dedicated to it. But at the same time, I highly, highly doubt that what was broadcast to the American public were the actual missions. And right. and the reason for that is warfare. I mean, my background in jiu-jitsu tells me, you know, if you're going to win a war or a battle, you know, a lot of it is perception. You know, it's if someone's afraid to fight you, it's way better for you than if than if somebody has no fear and thinks they're going to crush you.
Right.
You know? So essentially with, you know, the moon landing stuff, it's fascinating. It's outside of my scope of expertise of knowledge. But at the same time, if I were doing it, what I would do is I would not risk a public broadcast, you know, error in the spacesuit of one of our hero astronauts when the entire space race was based around a war of ideals. You know, it was a psychological war more than anything.
Right.
And then the possibility that they would just die on live TV. No, what I would do is I would do my missions if that was important, and then I would, you know, show the public the perfect, you know, footage to make them understand that we won.
Right. Yeah. I mean, especially decades before the internet, it'd be really risky to try to do that type of broadcast. I guess I'm kind of with you there. I think that the footage seems manipulated. Whether or not there's a real mission behind that footage, I mean, that's impossible to say because we have nothing to look at and judge. You know, you can judge the footage and see if you see some things in it that seem odd, like, you know, there being no impact crater underneath the module or there being no tracks near the rover. I mean, those things are interesting. There's also seems to be some duplicate backgrounds if you put the ridges, the mountainous ridges up against each other. So that stuff could all be on a soundstage, and that doesn't necessarily mean there wasn't a real moon mission. You know, I'm with you there. And I guess it's about winding down time. Jeremy, this has been awesome. Again, great work. Is there anything you're going to be working on next that you'd want to let the people know about?
Yeah, you know, I'm always gentle with what I say is coming next because I'll say one thing and then I'll get hit with, you know, this barrage of, you know, another story that breaks through. But what I'll say is just keep checking in to extraordinarybeliefs.com, and that's my website. And from there, you can even sign up for a mailing list, and then you will be the first to know. The only thing I have on the docket right now is I'm going to be speaking at the 2016 International UFO Congress, and I will be doing in the first half of the lecture a little update on some of my personal investigations, and then the second half of the discussion, my partner Ruben Langdon will be coming, and we will be doing a highlights from the citizen hearing and talking about what, in our eyes, they were and what impact, profound impact, they've had to date.
Nice. Right on then. Very cool. ExtraordinaryBeliefs.com is the website. And there you have it. Jeremy, it's been a blast. Keep doing what you do out there and take care of yourself, man.
It has. Thank you so much for having me on the show. And I'm going to continue tuning in and listen as you kind of go through unearthing all of these things that you are on your show. So thanks a lot, man.
Hey, thank you. And I'll be checking in with your movies, too.
Okay. Well, I'll send them to you, man.
All right. Peace. And that is all she wrote, people. Jeremy Corbell, big thanks to him. I think it was a random tweet where a listener said we should get together, and that led me to check out his work, and then we got to talking, and here we are. He does have some fascinating short films out there, and I know most of you will be familiar with names like John Lear and Bob Lazar, but it's been a while since I revisited these stories, and this made for a great way to talk about a lot of the big names that have become staples of the alternative world all within one episode. And I'm not sure how I feel about the Bob Lazar story and his credibility, but I totally think similar things to his story have happened, so I guess it doesn't really matter too much either way. Although Jeremy seems to have done his homework on it and doesn't seem to be one to go too far out on a limb without a reason, so I do take that into consideration. I think a lot of the topics we talked about and the people are the ones who really got me into this stuff in the first place, so it's fun and nostalgic to talk about, but looking back on some of it, I don't know what to think. And now I'm way more interested in occult connections and the idea that these beings we hear the whispers about are more multidimensional beings of consciousness rather than flesh and blood travelers from a distant star system because this gets into what all the rituals are about and the twilight language and the symbolism. I mean, who knows? Maybe they have the technology to harness both, or maybe we're dealing with two different things. Or maybe they're the inner Earth survivors of the Younger Dryas impact period, manipulating the surface world from the depths below. I like to give all these possibilities a fair mulling over. Either way, in the Plus show today, we talked about the subjects of some of Jeremy's other films, particularly one that focuses on Dr. Roger Lear and his experiences digging out creepy alien implants. That's pretty wild. We also talked about UFO summoners, other technologies, Jeremy's thoughts on Crow and the idea of a holographic moon, and he also relays a telling anecdote about Apollo astronaut Edgar Mitchell. But again, those moon landings. I mean, it's clearly faked footage, and both Jeremy and Chris Knowles make excellent and similar points, saying that it's naive to think they'd give away their secrets and missions so blatantly and out in the open. But the real curious question is if we win at all. I can't claim to know if there's a viable protection against the Van Allen radiation belt or if that's even a thing, but I am intrigued as hell by a lie that bold, and I love to hear a good case get made for it, and there's plenty out there. Either way, that is the fourth show of the month, one more in the chamber, but that means another Money Bomb winner, so those who participate in the donations also have a shot at getting half of the pie back in your pocket. I'll be picking someone probably tomorrow on the 29th, and then I'll have the last show for you on the 30th. Until then, that's it for me. Your move, elusive entities of the other world. Your frickin' move.
Two little men in a flying saucer flew down to Earth one day. Looked to left and right of it, couldn't stand the sight of it, and said, "Let's fly away." They took a look at a Western movie, somebody heard them say. If a horse can be a star, think how dumb the people are, we'd better fly away. Then they shook their little green antennas, scratched their purple hair. Said this planet is an awful menace, let's go back to where we came from. Two little men in a flying saucer just didn't care to stay.
No, no.
Said it's too peculiar here, headed for the stratosphere, and quickly flew away.
Look, people, we're well aware there isn't a shortage of podcasts in the world, but the Higher Side Chats is something special. And if you enjoyed the first action-packed power hour of speculation and education in today's show, know that you can listen to a second hour by becoming a member of THC Plus. For $5, you'll get 5 uninterrupted 2-hour episodes a month, a members forum, occasional bonus content, free downloads of THC's closing music, a private RSS feed, and the extra time in your day that wasn't wasted listening to unrelated ads. It's probably less than the tip for your last meal, and it's the collective power of small contributions that ensures the Carlwood can dedicate the necessary time to making great shows and provide the finely tuned first hour for everyone else. So just sign up at thehiresidechatsplus.com, read through the frequently asked questions page for information on the best ways to listen on your devices, and enjoy the ride. And since our humble host never wastes your time reading copy for NatureBox or Audacity, maybe you have an extra minute to share the show, review us on iTunes, follow THC on Facebook and Twitter, or help with any of the other half a dozen annoying things that must be done for a podcast to stay on top in this dog-eat-dog world.